Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's not quite, it depends on what the definition of is. But two little words from the Federal Reserve are getting a whole lot of attention from American public media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Risdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 9th of December. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. This has been a big news kind of day in Washington, D.C., our nation's capital. There was, as you know, the Senate's CIA torture report. There was another hearing on the Affordable Care Act and the comments an economist who helped draft that law made about how it got through Congress. And the House started in on a bill that would avoid yet another government shutdown. But we here will give you the news not of today, but of next week. How about that? The Federal Reserve will hold its last meeting of the calendar year next Tuesday and Wednesday, and there is a growing expectation that the Fed is going to do something crazy. You ready for this? It's going to take two words out of the statement it issues at those meetings, the tea leaves that economists and investors read to figure out what the Fed is thinking. But oh, not just any two words. The words are considerable and time, as in the Fed will keep interest rates where they are for a considerable time. Marketplace's David Gura reports on the thinking that goes into a monumental decision like that.
Ben Bernanke, then the Fed chair, first used the phrase in September 2012.
The committee emphasized that it expects a highly accommodative stance of monetary policy to remain appropriate for a considerable time after the economic recovery strengthens.
And that language has been in every Fed statement since, all 17 of them. Dana Saporta is an economist with Credit Suisse, and she says that first mention was a turning point.
It was a time in which the Fed was moving away from calendar-based forward guidance.
That is, tying policy changes to certain dates.
To thresholds.
That is, tying policy changes to inflation or unemployment. Guy Berger, U.S. economist at RBS Securities, says the Fed has been trying to telegraph something throughout the economic recovery.
Our policy is dictated by how the economy is evolving.
And maybe now that the Fed has stopped its multi-trillion dollar bond buying program, the economy has evolved enough for the Fed to signal to investors higher rates are coming soon. Why? Well, take last week's employment report. In November, the U.S. economy added 321,000 new jobs, and wages ticked up 0.4%. Mark Vittner is a senior economist at Wells Fargo.
When they look at domestic economic indicators, almost all of them have improved.
But, he says, that's not all that's on the Fed's radar.
The plunge in oil prices has caught a lot of folks by surprise.
And that's just one part of the global economy.
Right now, the rest of the world is a bit of a drag on the U.S. economy, and it presents some downside risk.
Vittner says Fed policymakers are keeping an eye on China's economy and Germany's. They've both slowed down. And that could affect the economy here in the future. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
I don't know how to tell you this, but Greece is back in the news. It was, of course, the white-hot center of the European debt crisis a couple of years ago. High unemployment, unsustainable pensions, and regular strikes and protests. And then we thought it turned around. More jobs, a buoyant tourism industry, and yes, a big bailout, too. But today, the stock market in Athens fell almost 10%, and as traders, like that guy in David's piece, like to say, the downside risk in Greece is back. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard brings us up to date.
It was Greece's Prime Minister Antonis Samaras who rattled investors. Greek lawmakers were due to vote in a new president in February. Samaras has brought the vote forward. Parliamentarians will have to choose now whether they support his candidate and therefore his pro-austerity policies. It's a big gamble that puts his government on the line, says Marcel Alexandrovich of Jefferies Bank.
Potentially looking at a new general election in Greece before end of January, and that's what's really spooking the markets today.
Because, he says, the front-runner to replace the Samaras government is the left-wing anti-austerity Syriza group.
I think a lot of sort of assumptions people are making about Greece, about what's going to happen to public sector debt, sort of the commitment to stick with repayments and so forth, I think those will be questions.
Many analysts say that Greece's recovery was anyway an apparition, that in reality the country is still essentially bust. Today's market turmoil was largely confined to Greece. The euro seemed unaffected. But, says Yanis Varoufakis, an economics professor at the University of Texas, don't be fooled. The whole eurozone is still in deep trouble.
The eurozone is a huge ship that is rudderless at the moment, buffeted by deflationary winds.
And he believes Greece could certainly make waves again for the whole currency bloc.
It doesn't take much to destabilize the markets more generally. And Greece is perfectly capable of doing this once more.
Investors, he says, should brace themselves for rough weather in European financial waters. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Wall Street started rough today, ended better, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Money, it has been said, is the mother's milk of politics, which does, in this post-Citizens United world, stand to reason. But increasingly, it's what that money can buy, specifically data, that is changing the game. Over the past couple of cycles, the conservative Koch brothers, Charles and David by name, have plowed millions of dollars into developing a state-of-the-art data operation. Ken Vogel writes about it in Politico. Ken, it's good to have you with us.
Hey, it's great to be with you.
I'm just going to quote you back to yourself from this piece. The Koch Network, you write, has developed expertise in polling, message testing, fact-checking, advertising, media buying, dial groups, and donor maintenance. They are, you say, basically a national party now.
Yeah, essentially they are a privatized version of the Republican Party, and they're not entirely consistent with the sort of ideas and platforms of the Republican Party, but that's what makes them so potent, is that they technically, if they wanted to, could support a candidate for president or for Senate who is different. So far, they've kind of been in line with the Republican Party, but that doesn't mean that they will do so in the future.
The working imperative here is that data is political power, right? Actionable data.
Yeah, that's right. And what we have here is the confluence of really the two defining trends of American politics, that being the outside big money that was sort of freed up by some of these recent federal court decisions, including the Supreme Court's 2010 Citizens United decision, and data, which is really the way to reach voters. Well, when you have this outside money paying for the latest technology, you really have a very potent force, and that's what the Koch brothers have, perhaps even more so than the Republican National Committee or the Democratic National Committee.
Yeah, yeah, we'll get to the Democrats in a minute, but the way that the Koch brothers are doing this, the vessel, the vehicle for their, one of them anyway, for their spending is a company called i360, which does amazingly granular stuff. Tell me about that.
So I-360 starts with this voter data that can be culled from secretaries of state's offices at the state level and then supplemented with commercial data that includes everything from estimated income, recent addresses, how often a person has voted, and even the brand of car that they drive. And what they do is they rent this data to campaigns or committees that are interested in using it through analytical modeling to reach very specific slices of the electorate, and allows them to come up with ways to target these specific slices with very precise messages that are tailored to them.
You write that these folks who are associated and affiliated with the Kochs are playing the long, long game. Forget 2016. They're looking 2018 and beyond as well.
Yeah, that's both with the technology. That is that they are trying to develop the sort of next wave of technology. And it's always about that next wave. What you saw the Obama campaign use so successfully and was so touted for its ability to use sort of social networking. Well, that was sort of started by the Dean campaign, Howard Dean's campaign back in 2004. So whatever you see in this particular, in this coming election cycle, 2016, is really kind of a beta test for what's coming next. And you won't even see the fruits of it until the next election, because they do see it as a long-term generational effort to shift the way that Americans approach politics.
All right, so back to the Democrats. Where are they in this? I mean, Obama, as you said, had all that success. Where do they stand?
Yeah, in many ways, the Democrats still are in the catbird seat, and they still do talk about themselves as being ahead. And the reason why is because Republicans really pioneered the last advance, that is direct mail. That was the one that Karl Rove used so effectively to help George Bush win two presidential elections. Hmm. The Republicans are playing catch-up. They're spending a ton of money doing so, and they feel that the combination of the party's efforts and even more importantly, the efforts by these outside groups led by the Koch brothers really have them poised to catch up and maybe even leapfrog Democrats in 2016.
Ken Vogel at Politico, writing about the Kochs and their data machine. Ken, thanks very much.
Hey, it was a pleasure.
We tell you every day which way Wall Street went and what Washington is doing and saying about the economy. There are more data and indicators than you can shake a stick at. But all of that pales in comparison to how things feel to you. We've been asking you that question the past couple of months. What's your economy like? Today, Phyllis Harrison from Long Island, New York.
I come from a middle-class background. My father graduated from a highly respected college, and my mother never worked. I found a career that I loved, and that was in mortgage banking. I worked my way up, gaining certifications, respect, credits, my MBA. In my 20s, I bought an affordable home. I paid off my student loans. I had savings. I had stocks and retirement. But with the recession, all of that started to fall apart. Mortgage banking was at a total standstill, and with the jobs gone, they never came back. What I did after this was start my own business. It did very well for a time, but a slowdown forced me to move in with distant relatives, along with my teenage daughter. Unfortunately, there was no quick, happy ending that they were expecting and that we were hoping for, and I have been unable to find work that will pay both my bills and rent. For the past 2 years, we've been living in our relatives' attic. They're tired of us, and I can't blame them. I'm tired of the situation, too. I'm thankful for the relatives that took us in, and I'm also thankful that my daughter is still in school, managing with stress and a job. I'm very thankful for the good friends I have helping me and offering moral support as well. And I'm thankful for the 3 jobs I have to pay my bills, most of them on time, and to keep my ancient car on the road. Many people I know have at least 2 or 3 jobs, so I guess that's an improvement in a situation where you can't find any jobs at all, but we still have a very long way to go. I remember good times, and these are not good times.
Phyllis Harrison from Long Island, New York. Do us a favor, take a minute and tell us how the economy feels to you. There's a spot you can do that on our homepage. It's marketplace.org. Coming up.
And when I usually ask them the question, why did you come back? Why did you come back?
Because it's home is why. Rebuilding in Eastern Congo. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 51 points today, almost 0.3%, 17,801. The NASDAQ traded up 25 points, 0.5%, 4766. The S&P 500 off a fraction of a point, call it unchanged, ended things at 2059. By way of corporate news, listen, how about a little game? I say the ticker symbol and the news, you guess the company, and we'll be good to go, all right? We'll start off easy here. Ticker symbol is MANU, M-A-N-U, down 10%. On the news, the son of former owner Malcolm Glazer will sell shares, MANU. That's a gimme, the soccer club, of course, Manchester United. All right, the symbol is SAVE, S-A-V-E. Descended 12% today after saying its average number of passengers declined last month. SAVE is Spirit Airlines, the discount carrier. All right, this one's really tough. It's the last one, too. Here you go. The ticker is ANF. Traded up 8% on word its CEO Michael Jeffries would retire. Jeffries was in hot water after saying that ANF products weren't meant for fat people. ANF, Abercrombie and Fitch. You're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace has been on the air for 25 years, and believe me when I tell you that could not have happened without support from listeners like you. So please, make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today and help us keep our coverage relevant and compelling. And you should know that your gift in any amount counts twice. That's thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from the Candida Fund. Donate at marketplace.org by December 31st and help us reach our goal of at least 2,500 donors. And thank you so much for your support. Also, this is Kai Rizdahl, in case you didn't know who this was.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, a look at the nation's balance sheet. The Treasury Department issues its monthly statement for November. A House subcommittee on health holds a hearing on the FDA's role in the regulation of genetically modified food ingredients. And on December 10, 1817, it became the 20th state admitted to the Union. The mockingbird is its state bird. Elvis was born there, and it's where Pine Sol was invented. Mississippi. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We were talking yesterday about how on any given issue, there are always economic winners and economic losers. Yesterday, it was the strong dollar. Today, it's falling oil prices. Winners include consumers here in the U.S. and elsewhere, of course. Losers include basically the usual suspects, oil companies in countries like Russia and Venezuela with weak economies that depend on oil revenue. But Marketplace's Dan Weisman reports that that big list of big losers and big winners has some big surprises.
In pure dollar numbers, the U.S. is the biggest winner. We import more oil than any other country. And when that oil gets cheaper, we save. But we've also got a great big economy to absorb all that saving. Guy Caruso is a senior advisor with the energy program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He says the discount might add up to 0.5% of our gross domestic product.
You know, it's not going to be a game changer for our economy, but it's definitely better with a plus in front of it instead of a minus, that's for sure.
Trevor Hauser has run the numbers on every country. He's a partner at the Rhodium Group, an economic research company. Yeah, big oil producers like Venezuela and Russia will lose a lot of income.
But it turns out that the countries that are the most vulnerable are those oil producers we don't ever really hear about.
For instance, if oil prices stay low, the Republic of Congo will effectively see about 27% of its economy disappear. Equatorial Guinea, 25%. Countries like Saudi Arabia that have been in the oil business a long time have socked away money for rainy, low oil price days. Not these guys. Even Venezuela and Russia are less exposed because their economies are a little more diversified. The list of big winners is interesting, too. Djibouti, Armenia, Singapore, Jamaica. What do they have in common? Here's Hauser.
If you're a small country and you're trying to generate electricity, you don't really have a lot of options other than oil combustion turbines.
These countries spend a lot of their GDP importing oil to keep the lights on. One surprise member of this group, Jordan.
Yeah, yeah. Not everybody in the Middle East has oil, man. There's a lot of people who are short. Jordan's pretty high up there.
As long as oil prices stay low, Jordan's got an advantage over some of its wealthier neighbors. I'm Dan Weisman for Marketplace.
The FBI said today that there is no confirmation that North Korea is behind the big hack that has practically paralyzed Sony Pictures. It has been more than 2 weeks since hackers calling themselves Guardians of Peace attacked that studio and sent trillions of pieces of company and employee data out into the open. Social security numbers, credit cards, salaries, medical benefits, actual unreleased movies as well. It is difficult to convert all of that into dollar terms. Estimates of damage are in the hundreds of millions of dollars, though. A share of it will be paid to lawyers and consultants and companies who help clean up the mess. And there is another economic impact that might be bigger still. All the spending by companies trying not to become the next Sony. Stan Alcorn has this story on what we're calling the hacked economy.
First comes the hack. Maybe it's Target or Home Depot or Sony. Then comes the money. Millions of dollars, first to clean up the cyber mess, and then on protection for employees or customers whose data was stolen.
With credit monitoring and identity theft insurance, so companies like Experian, Equifax, are doing very, very well.
Sasha Romanowski studies the economics of data breaches. He says the fact that Sony is doing this for thousands of its workers is more than just good PR.
In some of my past research, we've shown that when companies do provide those services, they're much less likely to be sued.
But those one-time expenses are small compared to what whole industries are spending to protect themselves. Julie Conroy of the ITE Group points to the theft of 40 million credit card numbers from Target last year.
Before the Target breach happened, there was a big question mark about whether the U.S. would really migrate to chip.
A chip could have kept those hacked credit cards safer. So, question answered.
We're going to spend in excess of $12 billion just on the hardware and the plastics.
Then there are the billions pouring into cybersecurity. Even though Gartner's Aviva Leighton says there hasn't been much success in actually preventing hacks.
The name of the game now is detect it as rapidly as you can and contain it.
And if you can't contain it, insure yourself against it. Here's Sasha Romanowski.
I think one of the winners of all of this are the insurance companies.
Cyber insurance barely existed just 5 years ago. This year, premiums are estimated to hit $2 billion. I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
The Eastern Congo has seen almost 20 years of chaos now. War and rape, looting and corruption, power struggles over the country's rare and valuable mineral wealth have all left their marks. The region is cautiously getting back on its feet, but sometimes the scars that war leaves behind aren't totally visible until long after it's over. In the first of five stories, Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports now on the difficult job of rebuilding in Eastern Congo.
This is what happens when 2 million desperate people flee for their lives through your town.
The Rwandan refugees with some militias, they took all the cattle.
Dario Wangayo Kusuku, who just turned 80, is remembering back to 1997. He owns a large farm in Masisi, about 50 miles from the border with Rwanda.
I lost 7,000 head of cattle, but for all the farmers, 650,000 head of cattle. And they broke the houses, they broke the tea factories. Everything was broken.
For the rest of the 90s and as recently as 2012, the Congolese army, Rwandan proxy militias, and dozens of different rebel groups fought for control of the region. The conflicts have become more intermittent. UN peacekeepers, who often stood on the sidelines, are taking somewhat of a more active role. So is the Congolese army. For now, security seems to be prevailing.
Things began to be a bit better. I think today is much easier.
His farm is doing a lot better these days. He's producing cheese and butter. Easier, though, does not mean easy. The infrastructure here is still in shambles. Very few roads are paved. Electricity is only on half the day.
Sometimes we've got no running water. There's water everywhere, except in the tap.
And yet, tucked in a small shopping center across from an abandoned grocery store is this. That is the new bread slicer in Goma's newest bakery, opened by Kasuku's daughter-in-law.
We are in the boulangerie au bon pain.
Vanessa Jados started this bakery not far from the UN base in Goma, Eastern Congo's capital city. It's part of a general economic stirring in the region that's taking advantage of a general decline in violence over the past decade.
Strawberry tart, pineapple tart, millefeuille.
Jados brought in a French pastry chef to train local cooks. They start each day at 5 a.m.
Why? Because I love the good things, like croissant, good bread. And here it was a problem because we don't have it.
Jados was one of the lucky ones who were sent away as a child to school during the worst of the conflict. She, like many Congolese, returned.
And when I usually ask them the question, why did you come back? Why did you come back?
Mwanza Singoma heads the North Kivu Chamber of Commerce.
The answer you always get most of the time is because it's home. It's home.
He also left the country before the worst of the wars.
I knew the country before the conflict. So I knew the country as peaceful. The way we used to walk around, to conduct business, and people used to feel very safe. I was like, why can't this come back again at some point?
Safety aside, starting a business here is rough, as Jados found out with her bakery.
There aren't
roads here.
They're still building them, so you need a good spot. We need a generator for electricity. Fuel is expensive.
The World Bank ranks countries each year by how easy it is to do business in them. Congo is number 184 out of 189. That's because the roads and electricity have issues, but so does the government bureaucracy.
When the equipment got here, people were everywhere bothering us about X tax or Y tax. There's always something new you have to pay.
She says it wasn't clear if all the taxes were even real. In some ways, the government is still oriented to the plantation economy of 50 years ago, not the post-war emerging economy of today.
I'm trying to do something to make conditions better. They should be helping.
Businesses like Jados have actually been successful in lobbying the government to lower some barriers. And even though Congo is still near the bottom of that World Bank survey, it's also one of the top 10 most improved in the world this year. GDP has tripled since 2007. Kasuku, the farmer, never again had as many cattle as he used to, but he has started planting more fruit trees.
Orange, graft mango, pineapple for making fresh juice factory.
He's built a health clinic for his neighbors and fixed 45 miles of road himself.
Someone has to do something. If we'll do nothing, nothing will be done.
In Goma, Eastern Congo, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, ending as we started, that is, with news of things yet to come. There's a press conference scheduled for tomorrow morning at which Michigan Governor Rick Snyder will ceremonially accept the resignation of Kevin Orr, the guy who officially put Detroit into and then got it out of the biggest municipal bankruptcy this country has ever seen. After adjusting $18 billion worth of debt, Detroit is going to end this fiscal year actually in the black. All right, we're done. We got to go. Today, the Dow off 51 points, almost 0.3%. The NASDAQ up 25 points, about 0.5%. The S&P 500 off just a fraction of 1 point, we'll call it. Yeah, unchanged, like we always do. Our special projects team is Nancy Pargali and Millie Jefferson. Lindsay Thomas and Caitlin Ash are on the Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producers are Raghu Manavalan and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APN.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.